Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Sunday Night Dharma Talk. Tonight, I'd like to continue to share some reflections with you on this topic of community. Last week, I introduced this topic, and I shared with you at the beginning this experience I had many years ago where I was living in a community that was for people living on the streets in London, and we were getting together and creating community. And the intention behind it was to meet a need, the need of community. And one of the ideas behind it was is that we have needs more than just food and shelter and water, but this also this need of community. And so it was really a powerful thing to be a part of. And I also shared with you that community is not only this basic need in terms of our lives, but it's an essential need for the spiritual path. I gave you that quote from the Buddha saying that spiritual friendship, noble friendship, is the whole of the holy life or the spiritual life. Really, this is such a key, this quality of friendship and community. And I kind of gave two dimensions to it. One dimension was that from community, one of the things I appreciate about it is that it reminds me of the wholesome qualities of heart that I want to cultivate. And the way that we most easily learn is through modeling. So if I'm hanging around with people that are mindful, it's easier to learn what it is to be mindful. If I'm hanging out with people that are kind and compassionate, it's easier to learn those qualities. So this is the essential, one of the key ways that we learn as human beings is just modeling off of each other. And then I gave the second aspect was to remind us how imperfect communities are, in case you haven't noticed. And what a wonderful thing that is. And I gave you the image that comes from Korean Zen of all these potatoes that they've just picked from the garden that are still dirty, and they throw them into a pot and they stir them around, and by bumping into each other, they become clean. And this is also, I think, an important aspect of community, is to bump into each other in a way that allows us to awaken the heart, to awaken the mind, to purify the mind. And I notice it by bumping into each other. So to me, it also normalizes and shows what a value it is when we have difficulties in a limited scope. Of course, I'm saying, in a community that is relatively safe. And tonight I just want to share with some reflections with you about how community can be not only a support, but an expression, the expression of the awakened heart. And I'd like to begin with a story that to me is a kind of inspiration of what a community would embody in terms of an awakened heart. And it's about a village in France, the village of La Chabon-sur-Lignon, and the villages surrounding this village. And this takes place in between the years of 1940 to 1944 during World War II. And this village, La Chabon-sur-Lignon, was a village of Huguenots. And what they did, which was really quite bold given how dangerous it was, is that they would take in Jews that were fleeing kind of the Nazi Holocaust. And they would take them into their homes. Most of them actually were children. And hide them there. And then when the Nazis were coming through, or that were supported by the Vichy government to round up people, they would have them flee into the forest so that when the Nazis were searching the homes and the buildings, they wouldn't find anybody. And then once they had left, they would actually sing this song that was the cue to know that it was safe. And they did this for years, and it said that they probably saved between 3,000 to 5,000 Jews during this time. And it wasn't only the Jews that were fleeing, but they were taking in other people. For example, Frenchmen were being rounded up to work in the forced labor camps in Germany. And then there was Germans that had an anti-Nazi bent that were also fleeing. So hiding a lot of people, and then they would also give them these forged ID cards in order to get into Switzerland to find safe haven. And I just find it so striking and moving that we're not talking about an individual, but an entire community that's involved in this. So often the stories I hear of compassion are really individuals. And what strikes me about the story of this village is that it was whole communities that were engaging in this, which I think is so moving. And just a quote from a woman who actually, as a child, was a refugee fleeing from Germany, coming from a Jewish family. And this is what she said when she arrived in the village of what it was like. She said, "Nobody asked who was Jewish and who was not. Nobody asked where you were from. Nobody asked who your father was or if you could pay. They just accepted each of us, taking us in with warmth, sheltering children, often without their parents, children who cried in the night from nightmares." Do you hear from that quote just this underlying current of compassion and the directness of it, of connecting with those who are fleeing? To me, this is such a beautiful expression of an awakened heart, a heart that's filled with compassion. And I want to tie this in with really the unfolding of this tradition that we're exploring together, of, you could say, early Buddhism. A different flavor of compassion, but see that it's rooted in compassion. In a discourse of the Buddha called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which it shares the last days of the Buddha, and you get to hear some of the last teachings that he's giving his monastics. And this is one of the last things he shares with the monastics. He's talking about these teachings that he had shared with them. And he says, "These you should learn thoroughly, cultivate, develop, frequently practice, and for a particular purpose, for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of all." And when I hear that, to practice and continue these teachings and this exploration for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and well-being and happiness of all, it makes me realize the only reason I'm practicing this tradition is because there has been communities, numerous communities, community after community after community, that has passed these teachings and these practices on to me. And it's been fueled by this quality of compassion. That's why we're all here. As groups of people coming together out of compassion, practicing together out of compassion, learning these teachings, exploring the spiritual path out of compassion. This, to me, is the expression of an awakened heart, a community that is in the form of a community, passing something on in this way. Whether it be meeting an essential need like safety, or meeting the need of a spiritual path or the spiritual life. How do we cultivate the skill of being in community as an expression of awakening? I want to share some thoughts about this. What comes to mind is this novel by Ian Forster entitled Howard's End. Howard's End. And the epigraph, which is a lot of times there's a phrase or a sentence at the beginning of a novel, which is really simple, just these two words, only connect. And to me, that's what's so important to remember around the cultivation of community, or you could say this cultivation of this interpersonal realm of our spiritual life, is to only connect. And if any of you have read the novel, I think there was a movie that was made about it as well. It's really the story about stepping out of one's own rigid way of relating to the world. There's one main character that's so rigid in his views. And towards the end of the novel, it's just this opening up and this empathic response. You see this empathy start to flow. as a result of struggling through this rigid view of the world. And I think that that's what this path is about on one level. I'm moving through the rigid way I hold the world, the rigid way I hold myself, that separates me from others. And as I move through that, I learn the skill of only connecting, just connecting. One of the things I appreciated about being a Zen monk during that training was just the simplicity of connecting with whatever we were doing. If you're working in the kitchen, connecting with cooking. If you're interacting with someone, directly connecting with them. When walking or running, connecting with that. When sitting, connecting just with sitting. When breathing, connecting just with breathing. And it reminded me of how simple and direct the practice can be to only connect. And now it's in this other realm, the interpersonal realm. And to me, this is the expression of awakening within a community when we can start to refine this quality of only connecting. But it's tough. Have you noticed that? It's not always easy. And we live in a culture where we might not always be supported by a kind of authentic connection. There's a great cartoon from New Yorker, and there's a woman on her cell phone, sitting next to her laptop, and it looks like a cup of tea. And she's talking to someone on the phone, and she's saying, "Yeah, a bunch of friends are coming over to stare at their phones." Connection sometimes ends up being that way, right? You get together with people, and everybody's staring at their phones. And it's such an addiction to it, such a huge addiction to this way, and it gets such in the way of connecting. Sorry, one more cartoon. And I'll have to explain it, because you might not be able to see it. So it takes place in a bar. And there's this woman there, and there's this man with one of those cones that a lot of times animals have, you know, when they get a surgery on. And she must have asked him, you know, "What's up with the cone?" And he says, "Well, it keeps me from looking at my phone every 2 seconds." Maybe this is the preliminary practice for us for connecting, is getting that cone. It's tough. So we have this technology that at times feels like it connects, but other times it disconnects. How do you navigate it? And there can be this underlying feeling within this, what I call mainstream culture, of a kind of disconnection. Years ago I was staying with a couple who used to come to the Sangha here. I think you know Andrea and Todd Tibbles, an artist, and Todd used to be in the Peace Corps. Down, I think, in Ecuador and El Salvador. And I think this is a friend of his that came from El Salvador, a small village in El Salvador. Had never traveled anywhere, and Todd had invited him to come stay up here in Albuquerque with them. And they live in, Los Ranchos de Albuquerque, this very beautiful place. And he was showing them around, and his friend said, "Yeah, so beautiful." But he said something to the sense, "But falta la humanidad." But it lacks humanity. And kind of he went on to say, "Where is everybody?" You know, in his village, everybody's always connecting. The basis is connection. The basis isn't success. The basis is connection. So he thought it was beautiful, but he thought it so strange to be in this world where the streets are not filled with people connecting. It's a challenge. This, what we're faced with, this simple practice of only connecting, in order to express this quality through relationship, through the interpersonal, through community. And some of this, I think, is internal, too, is the internal struggles around this. You might have noticed, I know I've noticed this in myself, and it's something that's been a part of my spiritual practice to navigate and to struggle through, is that often many of us have this deep longing for connection, a deep longing for community. And it's the question of how do you skillfully navigate that? How do you skillfully honor an important longing for community and connection? And one way, I think there's a number of different frames of how to understand this, but I think one element that disconnects us is sometimes the kinds of selves or the kinds of identities that come that create a kind of separation for us when we find ourselves in groups or in community. It can be the ongoing theme that can take so many forms of, I don't belong here, a sense of not belonging. And often the mind is fabricating this. And we can get so hooked by it, especially if we've experienced in the past experiences of being in a group and people telling us that we don't belong. But then what we start to do is we start to carry that around as if that's our motto or our theme. And when I say that, I don't want to disregard there are still group dynamics where we can be excluded for all kinds of reasons. And so it's not to deny that, the oppression that sometimes we can feel of coming into a group. But it's also to take responsibility that this is what our minds bring so often, is I don't belong here, that sense. And sometimes it doesn't take the sense of I don't belong. Sometimes it's a sense of these people don't belong to me. You know, it's not judging myself that I don't belong, but as if judging others like they're not good enough for me. And it can be so habitual that we're always feeling alone and isolated. And then underlying that, there can be the sense of, the threat of not being accepted. And again, there can be this underlying theme that something's wrong with me, or the underlying theme of something's always wrong with them. So it can be pointed inward or outward, but this theme. And a little bit deeper, sometimes a core impulse around this that I've noticed is this sense of not being enough. Which again can take two forms. I'm not enough, or the world I'm in is not enough. The group I'm in is not enough. And this can be a continual dynamic. And again, it's tricky, right? Because there is a place for discernment. Where is the community that fulfills you, that nourishes you? And that's a question, and not all communities are going to do that. So I do want to say there is the external piece of discernment, which I'm not going to talk about as much right now, but it is a real piece that we have to navigate and reflect upon. But I need to also own sometimes this internal piece of how am I perceiving things that might be tainted? And it can be the theme of never enough, or the communities out there are never enough. And as I mentioned last night, this can be fueled by the sense of, especially if we had a difficult upbringing, seeking the family we never had. And sometimes when we didn't get the family that we wanted, we start to seek that family that we never had. And I mentioned that the family that you never had doesn't exist, because it's usually an ideal family. And then you can hear, when it's idealized, then it's going to be always the quality of never enough. The group is never enough, or I'm never enough. Okay, so just a little bit more about this darkness. We'll pop out of it. But I have to share with you this image that I appreciate that explores this a little bit. And it comes from a Platonic dialogue called The Symposium. And to imagine here all these guys hanging out with each other, flirting with each other, and talking about love. And they're going around and talking about their versions of how they understand love. And Aristophanes, who was a playwright during this time, he was a comic playwright, so he wrote comedies. And to remember, a classic comedy in Greek times is the darkest view of humanity that you can have. And Aristophanes was brilliant at this. And so he tells a story. He tells a myth. He tells a myth of how once upon a time, all of us were these beings where we were connected with another being, and we'd go around in cartwheels. And these cartwheels would be two human beings connected together. Sometimes there'd be two men connected together, or two women connected together, or a man and a woman connected together, and they would roll around in perfect contentment. And then, as all good Greek myths go, they pissed the gods off in some way, right? And then, bam, they were all separated forever, left wandering the world looking for their other half to complete them. Talk about misery. If you're looking for another person or a community to complete you, I just want to say that is the perfect condition for dukkha, for suffering. It just doesn't exist. Finding that person. And there's such a, I mean, it seems like so many Hollywood movies are about that. They always end when people get together. But they forget the second part, you know, falling out. I think it's important to notice if this is what's fueling our seeking, our longing for community, our longing for connection. Because there's such a hook there. It's such a setup. And I think a practical thing to go about this, which I find so helpful, is when I'm interested, especially in community, so I want to talk about community more than relationship, is sometimes the question around communities is more is, what can I give to this community more than what can I get? Because it takes me out of this thing of needing to feel like I need to be completed by this. What can I give here? And do you see how that can change the whole feeling of that? And it takes us out of that dynamic. I remember when I was speaking with a friend who was going through a lot of struggles of this kind of stuff, and she was seeing a therapist, and the therapist gave her one thing to do, and she emphasized it again and again and again when she went to this therapist, and the therapist said, you know what you need to do? You need to volunteer a lot. And she said it was the best therapeutic intervention that she had in her entire life, because it snapped her out of this dynamic of trying to complete herself through community or through relationship. And then it became, oh, what can I give? And finding fulfillment through that. And again, of course, it'd be great if you could give in terms of the Sangha. You know, so there's a plug for the Sangha. But I think what's most important is to really find the community that feels right for you to give to. So we can undermine this dynamic of not enough, incompleteness, and have a different relationship to meet this longing for community and connection that's not based on completing oneself. So a little bit deeper with this. I think what's at the core of this movement of stepping out of not enough, or this movement towards community as an expression of our awakened heart, what can I give rather than what can I get, which I think is a beautiful expression of an awakened heart, is it's this movement both individually and collectively. Like I think we see this in this French village of Le Chabon-sur-Lignon, of stepping out of a self-centric world, beginning to move out of that. A more expansive way of seeing the world. And I think this is one of the things that we start to get a sense of through our meditation, of bursting this bubble, this balloon of a self-centric world. There's a Christian mystic by the name of Bernadette Roberts, and she talks about her kind of her movement towards this. It's really striking, the movement. She says, Along her spiritual path, she started to realize that kind of herself was this balloon filled with air, and there was air surrounding that balloon. And using her Christian terminology, her first kind of awakening was to notice, which was really huge, and she thought this was all the whole entire spiritual life, that the air in the balloon was the same as the air outside the balloon. It was all divine air, and that was a huge shift for her, and this real sense of connection. But she said that wasn't the finality of it. There was a deeper sense. And she says it was when the balloon dissolved, she used the word dissolved instead of popped, where there wasn't any barrier anymore in terms of this. Shantideva, who's an Indian Buddhist, very well known in the Tibetan tradition. This comes from the Bodhicharyavatara, the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, that the Dalai Lama says is his favorite book. And it comes from his chapter on equalizing self and other. And what emerges from that is actually this Tonglen practice later on in the unfolding of that tradition. He says, just as it is impossible to cut the sky in two with a knife, when the space-like quality of egolessness is realized, it is no longer possible to make a separation between I and other, and there arises an attitude of wanting to protect others as oneself and of taking them as one's own. So again, just as it is impossible to cut the sky in two with a knife, when the space-like quality of egolessness is realized, it is no longer possible to make a separation between I and other, and there arises an attitude of wanting to protect others as oneself and of taking them as one's own. Do you hear this analogy? You can't cut the sky in two with a knife. And that's why there's such an emphasis, even in early Buddhism, of coming to see how the self is something constructed. We get to see that we identify with certain aspects of experience, but it's just a process. And there's a place for identification. There's a place for a self, but I need to see that it's just a construction. And to go beyond this is this heart opening that we can see that Shantideva is expressing, and that's embodied and expressed like this a village in France, Le Chabon sur l'Union. And again, in order for us to get a feeling sense of this, what it takes is just the repetition of meditation and to see how the stories of me come up and to see that those aren't me, they're just stories. When an emotion comes up, to see that it's not me, it's just anger arising, it's just sadness arising and passing away. And what you might find through the repetition of just noticing this, noticing how experience arises and passes away, that there can be more of a fluidity, a more fluid relationship with experience. This quality of only connecting can begin to emerge more, both with our moment-to-moment experience and in this interpersonal realm. But I'd like to end with a story that, again, it's a dramatic story. And sometimes I hesitate to offer dramatic stories because often it can give the impression that the spiritual path is dramatic. And I think it's very important to know that huge transformation can happen on this path with nothing whatsoever dramatic happening. And that's the most important thing. The more I support individuals on this path and the more I realize, look at my own path, most the huge, deep transformations are not dramatic. They're not an aha. They're small. So that's the caveat. The only reason I tell this dramatic story is because sometimes a dramatic story sticks with us and can be inspiring in some way. But not to somehow look for the drama. And the reason I share it too is that I think for me, part of this balloon dissolving, using Bernadette Roberts' description, is that to me it's almost being torn out of this self-centric world. And I wish it was different. It might be different for you, but sometimes it does feel like being torn out of it in an uncomfortable way, but in a freeing way. And that's part of the flavor of a spiritual path sometimes, is that it's uncomfortable. It's destabilizing in some way because we're moving into a deeper way of being in the world. And if it feels unfamiliar and uncomfortable, then we know we're going in the right direction. So it's important to remember this about a spiritual path. It's not about seeking more comfort. It's about more freedom, which can be uncomfortable and unfamiliar. And I think this story will exemplify this a little bit. Again, dramatic, but helpful. So this probably took place 10, 15 years ago. There was a man who, his daughter was murdered. It was really a horrific murder, which I don't want to go into the details of. And, when the trial came around, I mean, this was, if you can just imagine losing a child this way. And he said he was just filled with rage during his life. asking this question, really, what kind of monster could have done this? And he said it felt like the murderer still had control of him in some kind of manner. And he said it was really quite striking at the trial. The trial actually went very quickly because the murderer completely confessed to it, pleaded guilty, and it was a very simple trial in that manner. And during the trial, he said he couldn't look at the murderer. But he had decided to write a statement really addressing the murderer and everyone in the courtroom. And I think the judge was hoping that he was going to give some kind of passionate plea to because I think they were looking for the death penalty for this person. So I just want to read you a little bit of what he said, really, to this murderer. His name was Ivan Simpson. He says, "I don't know if I've forgiven you, Ivan Simpson, but I don't hate you. But I do hate with all my soul what you did to my daughter. And then he continues. He says, "I wish for all of us that have been so wounded by this crime. I wish we might find God's peace. And I wish that for you, Ivan Simpson." And he said it was so moving. You know, he looked at the murderer who was, you know, devastated, you know, tears in his eyes around this. And he said it was like looking, like seeing a soul in hell when he looked at the murderer. And it was actually quite striking because the murderer had asked to go up to say something. And he just said something very simple. You know, he said, "You know, I am so sorry for the harm that I've done." And so this father who had lost his daughter was just quite moved by that small statement that he had made, and actually reaches out to the murderer and writes to him when he's in prison. He has a life prison term, and says, "You know, my daughter tried to make a better place, make the world a better place. We should also try." And Ivan writes back, and he says, "God bless you in all things. I know God has forgiven me, you have forgiven me, but I cannot forgive myself. I don't know the kind of love your daughter had for the world, but if it is anything like yours, it is great. Feel free to ask me anything you like." And after that, he writes a letter back to ask the murderer to tell him, ask Ivan to tell him about his life. And they start to have this interchange where he really starts to hear about, you know, the horrific upbringing that he had and the difficulty. And they even get into, he wants to hear the details of his daughter's death, which Ivan gives to him, and really discuss the whole situation of what was going on before and after. And of course there's drugs involved, and of him seeking drugs. He was really in this place of drug addiction. And he said it was amazing. After the years went on, they just started to interchange these casual letters about growing flowers and their days and the sun rising and the sun setting. And he'd be sending him gifts, like Christmas gifts and things like that. There was this deep, deep friendship that arose. And he said it was so striking to him, like Hector reflected on himself, because it made no sense to his mind. He said at one point, after he had sent a Christmas package to Ivan, he said to himself, "You crazy old man, you are sending Christmas packages to the man who murdered your daughter. What is wrong with you?" And actually, to this day, I think they're still writing letters to each other. This deep connection in terms of this. And what I want to point out about this story is a few elements which I think are so important. One is how incomprehensible I think that world can be when we enter it. The world of moving beyond ourselves. If we've lived a life situated around me, our actions might not make as much sense, and I think that's a good thing. And so I want to distinguish this spiritual path from other spiritual paths, some other spiritual paths, is this isn't about making sense of the world or bringing deep meaning to it. In some ways, it's using that at times, but it's also the willingness to go beyond this. Where we might find ourselves doing quote-unquote crazy things, like being compassionate to people that we would never think of being compassionate to. And you might hear how his self was wrapped up in that, and there was a tearing out of that. He had to tear out of the identity of the man who had the daughter who was murdered, who shouldn't be writing to the man who murdered her. And I think when we start to tear out of that, that's when we can start to express this bigger heart, this awakened heart that can take the form of the interpersonal like this, which takes the form of a community that can build a village like those French villages in France during the war. And again, it comes back to this simple practice that we're doing, showing up for our experience, connecting with it, noticing the fabric of it, that there's not really any solid, fixed self there, and allowing that to move into a more of a quality of fluidity. So may our practice here together tonight lead to the liberation of all beings in the form of community. Thank you.